Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, January 29th. Today we get the latest on housing for wildlife survivors on Maui. There's been an extension of a FEMA program until 2027. You've heard of Noah's Ark, but have you heard of the Limu Ark? We introduce you to a scientist on the island of Hawaii who's working to preserve rare seaweeds. We also meet a shopper with a different take on the economy and ask what's in her cart. And we take you inside a boxing ring as Palolo prepares to rumble in the valley. And we hear from Hawaii students about what it's been like to be a part of a major exhibition at one of the largest museums in the world. A voyage by our ali'i 202 years ago gets the spotlight in a new exhibit at the British Museum in London. You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Governor Josh Green was happy to announce during his State of the State address on Monday that the state had reached agreement with FEMA to extend the housing assistance for the Maui wildfire survivors. The assistance had been slated to expire next month. HPR's Maui Nui reporter Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel joins us with more. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
I imagine, oh gosh, families just must have been breathing a sigh of relief.
Absolutely. They were really, you know, in limbo, kind of on pins and needles, as they described, waiting for this decision. You know, the housing had originally been allocated through FEMA assistance to last for 18 months. And so it was extended once, and as you said, it was set to expire next month, originally on February 10th. It did get extended a couple weeks until February 28th. And so it was just this like little by little process of people not knowing whether they were going to have to vacate housing. This is affecting over 900 fire survivor households. And so all of those folks were just, you know, not sure if they would have to leave their housing and find new housing in a market on Maui that is already really, really, really challenging to find any housing, let alone something that's going to be affordable for them. So huge sigh of relief, absolutely. The state had requested this extension for one more year until February 2027, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security secretary did finally approve it. And so, you know, this process has been really a source of anxiety for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Can't believe it.
And so these are folks who are living in FEMA's Kilohana housing unit, which is a modular home community that they built specifically for fire survivors in Lahaina, just over 160 units there. It's also affecting folks who are in direct lease units. So this is housing that, you know, individual houses that are under lease, and many do receive payment assistance by FEMA. And also folks who are, there's some temporary housing units on private property around Lahaina, and also the rental assistance program. So where households will go and find their own rentals, but they will get that assistance toward their rent through FEMA as well. So all of FEMA's housing assistance programs were affected by this. And, you know, this one more year for folks to, and the state and county, to kind of figure out a transition program here. So FEMA and the state have focused on temporary housing while the county is focused on sort of rebuilding and longer term solutions.
Where are we at
on
that?
One of my questions. Yeah. So, you know, with building permits, 125 in Lahaina have been completed. So those are fully up and, you know, hopefully folks are living in them now. About 500 permits for rebuilds in Lahaina have been issued. So those may be in, you know, the process of being built. 27 of those are non-residential. So again, the focus in the rebuilding efforts has certainly been on rebuilding homes, and, you know, commercial and non-residential buildings are sort of coming along at a slower rate, and over 300 permits are being processed right now. So their requests for the permits have been in so various stages. The federal CDBG disaster recovery funds, $1.6 billion, is helping. The Ho'okumuhō program through the county had a huge response to their first-time home buyer program. They had over 1,000 applications. The county did tell me that they're only able to fund, you know, maybe 150 or 200 of those applications, but there was a huge interest in that. And, you know, there's some longer-term projects as well, just to create more housing stock in general. But one of my questions was, what happens to this modular housing that FEMA put up, you know, after the deadline, and, you know, people have to vacate? Does it sit empty? It's still unclear, but here's what Mayor Bithin said about it at a recent Lahaina meeting.
Before FEMA brought the first structures over here, they had conversations with both the governor and myself about what would be the exit strategy of those structures. And FEMA has a few options that they offered, or that they do in disasters like ours. One of them was to remove them, return the property to the original condition that it was in before they put that structure on there. The second was to sell it to the homeowner or the landowner that the structure was sitting on. The third is to give it to the state or the county at no charge, and the state or the county would decide. You could probably imagine what it cost and what it took to bring many of those structures from the mainland or even outside of the country to Maui. Very, very expensive. It would probably cost just as much to remove them and take them back. Both the governor and myself agreed that we would take the structures for free. Like we said, we take them at no cost. And that's the last we talked about it. It's up to FEMA to decide if they'd rather remove them or give them to us for free.
Yeah, so we're keeping our fingers crossed that we get that housing so we can repurpose it.
Yes, absolutely. One more year to figure it out now, and we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HBR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can read her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Aloha kākou. Join Hawaii Public Radio as we continue honoring Mahina Alelo Hawaii. As part of Live from the Atherton, we welcome Native Hawaiian artist Lady Laritza for a special Valentine's Day performance. Join us on Saturday, February 14th. For tickets, go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
We now take a trip to the island of Hawaii, where University of Hawaii at Hilo researchers are working to preserve limo biodiversity. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote went to Hilo to speak with Professor Carla McDermott about a project called the Limu Ark. Think of it like a seaweed seed bank. Take a listen.
How many species of limu or seaweed do you think you could identify just by touch?
Me? Or anybody?
You.
Oh, that'd be, put a blindfold on me. Well, I don't know. We have 671 species in Hawaii. Oh, I don't know. Maybe about 40.
Pretty good.
And then if you let me taste them, there'd be we can add on to that.
Carla McDermott stands in front of what looks like a giant bathtub of floating red seaweed. It's Halimenia hawaiana, a native limu also known as Lepe Ohina. McDermott trails her fingers through the floating strands.
It's almost therapeutic to play with it.
McDermott has been a marine science professor at the University of Hawaii at Hilo for more than 3 decades. In that time, she's taught generations of students to love limu. She herself was trained by Isabella Iona Abbott, a.k.a. the First Lady of Limu. Abbott was the first Native Hawaiian woman to earn a Ph.D. in science and a foremost expert in marine algae.
She taught us all how to cook with seaweeds. And so I have continued that legacy in my marine plants class. So the last lab, instead of, you know, extracting pigments or identifying specimens, we have a limu luncheon. I break the students up and give them all of the ingredients. Each team gets about 3 recipes. Pot stickers, tempura, cupcakes. We make everything smoothies from the drinks to the dessert.
That cupcake recipe is actually adapted from one of Abbott's original recipes. Needless to say, McDermott is always looking for creative ways to engage her students in the study of limu. Last year, she teamed up with fellow UH professor Maria Hawes and 3 students to create something brand new, but inspired by one of the oldest conservation success stories, Noah's Ark. McDermott started a project called the Limu Ark at UH Hilo's Pacific Aquaculture Facility. It's a grand idea, but the ark itself is a little unassuming, to say the least.
And this is the ark. I don't put up big signs, and it's just a container. It's a mats and container. But
surrounded by overgrown cane grass, it's easy to miss. But inside is a remarkable living library of native limu. Red, green, and brown clumps of seaweed float in tubes and flasks. McDermott picks up a specimen that's so darkly colored it almost looks black.
Oh, this is a species, Chondrus retortus, no Hawaiian name. It's a species that's known from Hawaii and Japan and Korea.
How this particular species made its way across the Pacific is a question McDermott and her colleagues have puzzled over. One theory is that Japanese immigrants brought it with them to Hawaii in the 19th century.
That's not your favorite theory.
No. If I were traveling, I think I would bring nori, not this.
It's possible that natural currents brought this limu over, or even a really big wave.
Could it have come on tsunami debris? Ancient tsunami, just like the one from Fukushima, and seaweeds did travel all the way across the Pacific to Oregon.
The Limu Ark can help solve these types of mysteries by preserving seaweed biodiversity. About 70 species are currently represented in the collection, all harvested in the wild in Hawaii's waters. It's a reference library of sorts for people looking to identify specimens they've collected or who are looking to cultivate a species for food.
The other thing, and I'd have to keep up more, would be to have this available so a teacher, let's say an 8th grade teacher, said, I want to have for my class, and I've done it before, they'd say, I want 1 green, 1 red, 1 brown for my lab this week.
McDermott says new native limu species are commonly identified and formally recorded for the first time. But researchers are also noting that some limu species are becoming less abundant.
I've been here on this side of the island since 1994, I said, working at UH Hilo. And there are some species I can't find when I go on field trips with my students anymore.
And she's not exactly sure why some native species seem to be disappearing.
Is it more road runoff from more cars? Is it climate change, warming of the water itself in surface waters? Is it more nutrient? I don't know.
McDermott says these observations are part of what encouraged her to create the Limu Ark. And there's one particular loss she still thinks about.
We used to have a population of Lawrencia galtzoffii. It's a real beautiful little red that grows in a, like a bouquet. And it was out at Waiopai tide pools. And that was the only place on this island that I could find it growing, and up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands.
The Waiʻopai tide pools and Kapoho Bay were lost in Kilauea's 2018 eruption.
As the lava started coming out of the fissure and making its way towards Waiʻopai and Kapoho, I kept saying, I should go down there, I should go get it, I should go collect some. But I didn't. And then the lava covered everything, houses, and people lost so much, but it covered the reef. I think that made me think, because if we had had a little sprig of it, I would have nurtured it and maybe outplanted again after the lava cooled.
With Limu Arc, McDermott hopes to ensure that another generation of marine science students get to know Hawaii's rare limu species. And perhaps just as McDermott picked up the mantle from Isabella Abbott, one of those students will carry this work forward.
I don't know. It gives me pride to think that I'm preserving my major professor's legacy. She could identify all these species, one look at them under the microscope. And so preserving her knowledge with my limited knowledge, you know, by growing them, keeping them alive, maybe for other people to study in the future. I just think it's the right thing to do, and I love seaweed. Mm. Also, I'm growing seaweeds, but I'm growing students, and that gives me great pride because they carry on a bit of me, too.
Yes. That was UH Hilo Marine Science Professor Carlo McDermott and HPR Savannah Harriman Pote. They were talking about efforts to preserve Hawaii's native seaweed by building a limu ark.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, providing local businesses customized energy plans. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
New local programming is coming to HPR on Sunday afternoons. It's called HPR Hōʻike. It's a weekly showcase for new music and storytelling events produced in-house right here at HPR. You'll hear our Live from the Atherton concerts, as well as thoughtful discussions with local artists, authors, and practitioners. Join us for HPR Hōʻike every Sunday afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union. Learn more about home loan options with an appointment at hawaiistatefcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohawaii.
Today, we're testing your memory of the concert scene around the world. 53 years ago this month, Elvis Presley took the stage at what was then known as the Honolulu International Center to perform Aloha from Hawaii. At the time, it was the most expensive entertainment special to produce, costing some $2.5 million. It marked the first time an entertainment special by a solo artist was broadcast live around the world. Millions watched the special. It's been suggested that up to 70% of television watchers in Hong Kong, South Korea, and the Philippines tuned into the concert. Since this was before the creation of pay-per-view, there was no way to charge an entrance fee to virtual concert goers. Instead, Elvis urged the audience to donate to a cancer fund in honor of a Hawaiian singer-songwriter. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this influential 20th century musician? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right. You can do anything but lay all of my blues away. Double my blue pressure.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Time now for a new installment of What's in Your Cart. We recently were out at the Foodland market on the North Shore of Oahu, and that is where HPR's G.W. Gibson met Eileen Gibb, an annual visitor from Plymouth, Massachusetts. She had just arrived the day before and was stocking up for her stay.
I bought milk and some crackers, some pokey, some snacks, and some libation.
So you're from Massachusetts. Did you notice anything in particular about the shopping experience here that's different from your experience back home?
Well, prices are different, but not significantly higher, you know, out of reach higher. They're higher than they are up where we are in Plymouth, but it's vacation and you're willing to pay the price.
And were there items that you were looking for that you weren't able to find here?
No, I've been fine. I actually stopped at Costco on the way up and bought some basics that I knew actually that were on sale.
Are you a frequent visitor to Hawaii?
Yes, this will be my 24th year coming. My husband passed away a couple of years ago, and I just decided I wanted to come back. We had been coming. Tomorrow I'll do a major provisioning in terms of, you know, all the basics, cleaning and napkins and toilet paper and all of that. I'll actually do that on Monday because it's the weekend, so you don't go shopping on the weekends in Hawaii. I remember that.
What did you find about shopping on the weekends in Hawaii?
The lines.
How are you feeling about the economy in general terms?
I am retired. And I am a Trump supporter, and I know that that is not a popular thing with the NPR, but I'm proud to say that I am. I am confident that the economy is on the right direction. It's going to take a little while because of tariffs. I mean, I've noticed the difference, and I will complain like everybody else. Why do I have to pay double the amount that I was paying last year? But I recognize that in the long haul, it'll be worth it.
So you feel like there's some difficulty in the short term, but you trust the president's vision in terms of what he's trying to do in the long term?
Very well put. You put it better than I could say it, yeah.
And what were some of the things that drew you to him as a voter?
I like his policies. I like what he's doing. I recognize that his personality leaves a lot to be desired, and I understand why the other side can't stand him. But this is president is not a beauty contest. It's who can get the job done. And the other side didn't have anybody that showed me that they could do what he's doing.
Well, and you've picked two spots for yourself, Massachusetts and Hawaii, where he's not very popular. So you're an outlier.
I knew that. I knew that was, I knew that was, yeah. So I don't talk politics. I mean, most of my friends are diehard Democrats. I mean, and they can't get past, we hate Trump. I mean, well, I don't care whether you hate him, but what do you people stand for? What are you going to do?
So it sounds like you feel like you've been able to keep friendships up, but you've just had to put politics aside as something you discussed.
Exactly. And here I don't intend to. I won't discuss politics either.
We pulled it out of you here at HPR.
You did.
That was Eileen Gibb visiting from Plymouth, Massachusetts. She spoke to HPR's G.W. Gibson at the Foodland on the North Shore of Oahu. What's in your cart? How are you feeling about the economy? We do want to hear from you. Comment on our social media posts or write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters Kau Wood Valley, with notes of guava, vanilla, and pink grapefruit, supported by Cacao Nib. More at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com.
You are invited to play trivia with HPR Generation Listen on the first Tuesday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and meet with fellow HPR fans. Generation Listen is an HPR initiative that connects young and the young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving Hawaii and supporting local businesses, including collaborations spotlighting local creators. Upcoming collabs at shop.zippies.com.
The Hawaii Winter Boxing Festival kicks off this weekend, and competitors from Oahu, Hawaii Island, Maui, and Canada are ready to rumble in Palolo Valley. Joelle Kim is the longtime coach of the Palolo Boxing Club and a former competitive boxer. The Conversation's Kevin Allen stopped by the ring recently. He spoke with Kim and his assistant coach about the impact that the gym has had on the Palolo community.
Coach Joelle Kim. I've been here coaching at Palolo Boxing Gym since 2001, so I guess that makes 25 years, a little bit. And I used to box out of Palolo Gym in the 80s and 90s. So I've been floating around here probably for about the last 50 years now.
How did boxing kind of find your way into your life?
Well, I grew up a small guy, right? And when you're small, of course, you get bullied and you either learn how to defend yourself, or there's other worse things that could happen, right? So I learned how to defend myself. I took wrestling and boxing, and it gave me more confidence. Started competing when I was 14, and I fought all the way up till off and on. I took some breaks when I had kids, but up to about 30, and I had a little over 100 amateur matches, so competition matches.
How many wins?
I was about 80%. I can't win them all, but if I was to judge my own matches, I would have won 99%, right?
Why did you get into coaching?
Even as when I was a boxer, I always helped out my younger brother or other newer guys at the gym. I enjoyed teaching them a little bit. And then when I became a teacher, a school teacher, back in 2001, here in Palolo, I had a lot of antsy kids, and it was kind of a incentive for them. I gave them, offered them incentive. You can quit hitting each other in class when I'm trying to teach you and stay focused. I'll take you to the gym after school and you guys can work out and glove each other out and nobody will say stop. I guess when I first started coaching, I was really more hands-on than, you know, now after about, now that I'm in my 60s, I don't really get in the ring and spar with everybody as they're up and coming. I think when I first started as a coach, I wanted to be up there with everybody, you know, and more of a hands-on. But now I'm more of the guide on the side than the sage on the stage, you know. It's a transition we make.
From hitting the bags, doing circuit training, and even getting in the ring to spar, I think boxing you know, always really took a lot of discipline and it took a lot of mental fortitude. How have you kind of seen those traits carry over from not just being in the gym, but in your day-to-day life for your students as well as for yourself?
Yeah, I find that not only for myself, but especially with the students, what gives me a joy and a kind of a passion to come here is I see they're becoming better people overall, right? They become, they get a better work ethic, which carries out in the professional life, in real world. They can hold jobs, they can join the military, they have a better work ethic. They become leaders, not just followers, you know. They know what it's like to have to work hard to get something. They have to have discipline themselves, everything from what they eat to, you know, their sleep and their fun times versus the work time. So it's a lot of good skills that carry out into the real world. Kids in general, they like competing. You know, they like sports. They like the action. They like to, you know, put their energy and effort into something and be noticed. I think with boxing, it transitions well for a lot of kids that they don't equate well with team sports or the larger group sports. So they're more into individual growth and sports. I think that helps a lot of them, gives them something to belong to. And every kid wants to belong to something. They want to compete, they want to develop, become the best them they can be. And we help those that have a liking or pull towards the boxing and individual sports. We try and appeal to that.
And I've always noticed that boxing gyms are like families. You talk about wanting to belong to something.
Yes.
I do feel like belonging to a boxing gym is like belonging to a family. Yeah. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, it's great to see that, you know, again, these guys that are not really into the team sports, don't really have a big group that follows them, have something to belong to, and then they build on it. You know, they build their experience, their records. They love collecting the medals and trophies or belts that they win, and they love sharing their videos of sparring or training or competition with their friend. And I think they see folks respect them, and it gives them something to work, strive for.
It's been interesting too, I feel like, in this age of social media, we've also seen a lot of unregulated fighting, guys in a ring just going at it. Can you tell me why it's really important to do this kind of thing in a structured environment?
That's a good thing about amateur boxing. It is structured for the safety of the kids. In fact, they've done studies and they found that high school golf has more injuries per student than amateur boxing. And it's just because of the protective devices, the safety machinations that are built into the actual competitions, right, and the events, whether it be the shorter rounds, the bigger gloves, you know, the standing eight counts, trained and experienced officials. And we have a system where they compete against folks of their own competition level as they progress. So I think it's structured for safety. And above all, we want our kids to be safe. We don't want them getting arrested or in trouble out there for doing something silly that was triggered on by another silly act, right?
Can I interject? Can I say something?
Absolutely. Can I just get your full name and your position here as well at the gym?
Sean R. Wilson. I'm Joe's assistant coach. What I wanted to say is that I've known Joe for over 20 years, and boxing builds relationships. And I know he's known some guys for about 30 years, so that's another plus side of boxing, is it builds relationships.
Now you guys have the Winter Boxing Fest coming up, and I feel like that is where you see all of these relationships really come together, not even locally, but internationally, but also around the state. Tell me a little bit about what's going on this winter at the end of this month.
Yeah, it is. It's actually the first amateur boxing competition of 2026 for Oahu and Honolulu. And it's an annual event we've been having for about 5 years now, the Winter Boxing Festival. And we usually get invites from the West Coast, Canada, and we've had Japan come in off years as well. So this year we're excited to have Canada coming again, a team from Nova Scotia, and top teams from Maui and the Big Island as well.
And tell me just how important an event like this is for a lot of amateur boxers here locally. Are there a lot of events like this, or is this something that really, you know, they're looking forward to and wanting to compete?
I feel like it's coming back. There was a time when there was only a few shows, you know, a few chances for local kids to actually compete, show their skills, and develop locally a year. And now we're getting to where it's getting quite busy. A couple times a month, there are opportunities for competition. I think that it helps the kids develop. It prepares them better for the bigger stage, like the national, regional tournaments, whether it be the USA Nationals, the Golden Gloves, Silver Gloves, the PAL. It gives them that confidence and experience to get in there and travel and compete well.
I think it's really so cool that it's happening right here in Palolo. Why is it so important to have something like Palolo Boxing Club here just as something for the community?
Well, Palolo is, again, one of the lower income, high risk area for youth. It has had a history of gangs and different problems, and we're trying our best to provide alternate activities for the youth so they can participate in a community event, community sports program that's safe. It leads to other opportunities, builds good qualities that they can transfer again into the work world, whether it be school, military, or professional career.
Do you notice a lot of maybe those kinds of youths who have too much energy or something along those lines? Do you notice a lot of them coming into the gym and kind of looking to burn it off?
Not as many as we'd like to, but we do have our share that come in, and it's great because for every one we come in, it kind of inspires 3-4 others of their friends and kids here in the Valley. It's easy to follow the bad examples, right? There's enough of them around, but we're trying to provide venues for them to be good examples.
He doesn't beat his own horn, but I've seen him over the years change people's lives, young boxers' lives. They were gang members.
We started with, of course, coming in having fun, right? The more you have fun doing something, the more you're going to participate in it. So we try to add life lessons along with the fun, skill lessons, how to develop in the sport and the martial art of boxing, conditioning, and develop a love for the sport. And once they do that, we don't have to push them that hard to train, right? Kind of tricks them into coming and training. And they feel like they're a part of something fun that they develop in, they get noticed, they get some recognition in the, whether it be in the newspaper or their community.
Wrapping things up, you said you've been here for half a century at this point in Palolo Boxing Gym. Out of those 5 decades, do you have any big major takeaways?
I feel like this is like a time capsule for me. When I come here, I hang out with the younger folks that are working hard and driving hard, got a good work ethic. It inspires me as well, keeps me younger. And I feel like I say, it feels like I come to a time capsule and age less or more slowly when I'm here. So I guess it's mutual benefit, you know, for not only the kids, they can mature and develop, but I could stay young, feel like a kid again.
And Coach builds up a relationship that lasts a lifetime, And but he's not tooting his horn, but I'm going to toot his horn anyway.
I'd like to echo that. That's another thing. It's not only seeing the kids develop, but you become part of that development. They bring you into their families, and you know they become part of your family, and you become part of theirs as well. It's kind of good because your family grows over all the sides of the island.
We've been hearing from Palolo Boxing Club coach Joel Kim. He spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about amateur boxing in the islands. The Winter Boxing Fest takes place this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Palolo Gym. We'll have links to learn more on our website later today. Time now to strum along the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we took a trip down memory lane and remembered Aloha from Hawaii. The massively popular Elvis Presley event was the first concert to be televised live around the world. This month marks 53 years since his performance at what is now the Neil Blaisdell Center. But we wanted to know about another musician. This Roosevelt and Kamehameha Schools graduate died tragically young, but not before he made an impact on the music scene in Hawaii and around the world. Our mystery musician was born in 1932 and began composing songs as a teenager. His teachers thought he was a quick learner, but he was expelled from school for acting out in class. He served in the U.S. Coast Guard and then moved to the continent, where he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and worked at the Lexington Hotel Hawaiian Room. Now, this artist's life was cut short by lymph gland cancer. He died in 1966 at the age of 34. We wanted to know the name of this musician whose cancer fund Elvis Presley urged viewers of Aloha from Hawaii to donate to. And we were looking for Kui Lee. And Nick Francisco from Puna on the Big Island knew that. He was our winner. And that was our quiz for the day. If you have one to share, write to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'll remember you long after this endless summer is gone. I'll be lonely, oh so lonely, living only to remember you.
The British Museum in London opened a new exhibit 2 weeks ago today entitled Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans. We've been featuring stories about the show, and we were fortunate enough to be there for the opening. You know, there were hopes that someday some of those artifacts could make it back to the islands as part of a traveling exhibit, or perhaps, you know, find a home in a permanent exhibit there in Great Britain. Those are some of the wishes of those who took part in the show. We were able to talk to many young people from Hawaii who were honored to be there for the opening. And this spring, a group of students from Kamehameha Schools will travel to London to see it firsthand. Kumu Janelle Picaro works with the Ambassador of Aloha Aina program at Kamehameha Schools, which for the last decade has been bringing students, or haumana, to help trace the journey of Hawaiian monarchs in Europe. Picaro was part of a stewardship group that has been working with the British Museum staff on the exhibition.
So we brought about 48 haumana in October of 2024, and we were blessed to be able to see some of these items in the collections area, including Kamehameha's Ahu'ula. And it was that moment that kind of brought us together with Dr. Alice Christophe, and having her come along with us to some of the places that we do research at, like Windsor Archives, where the letter was housed, and the National Archives in Kew Gardens, where the Anglo-French proclamation is housed. So having her come along with us on those huaka'i allowed us to share some of those personal stories with her. And so that's where we started to talk about what she had planned for this exhibit. So, you know, I'd like to think that we were able to bring some of our haumana's voice and their experiences to this place.
Yeah, how they were feeling about what they were seeing. And then this spring, there will be a group from Kamehameha Schools coming to see this exhibit. Will they be the same students or a different crowd?
Yes, so in March, during our spring break, we are actually going to bring about 68 haumana from Kapalama campus from grades 9 through 12. Some of them will be repeat returnees, but the majority of them will be brand new, and this will be their first time experiencing this. It's a big feat to bring that many students and, of course, the adults to chaperone, but we thought it was very important that we brought as many Hawaiians to see this exhibition, because this collection is unlike anything that we've seen, and these items are here together for the very first time in history. So this is important for us, and we're excited. They're very excited to be here. And so being here now gave us the opportunity to plan that out, to make sure that their experience is a very good experience.
And so what's the idea behind the ambassador program?
Yeah, so our ambassadors, we've been traveling for about 10 years. The idea behind it is we very early on found that our ali'i, our mo'i, our leaders, our kupuna even, were very diplomatic. They created and forged these relationships with different leaders from across the world. And, you know, as we start to dive into some of that research, understand that these relationships, some of them are still in existence. And so for us, we research them and then we retrace their footsteps. And we're able to, you know, visit some of the places that they visited, see the documents, see some of the things that they saw. And for our students, it gives them that confidence that if my ali'i or my kupuna can do that, you know, so can I. It's a really neat thing to experience as a young person, as a young Hawaiian, especially now, because it builds so much confidence in them. But it also proves that our people are brilliant. Kalakaua sent students across the world to learn from different places. And the goal was always to bring back that knowledge and that ike to Hawaii. And that's the same goal that we have, right? Everything that we learn, we bring that back to our communities. We look at the pride in the diplomacy, in the relationships that they created. But now in this exhibition, we look at the pride in their craftsmanship. You know, we look at all of these mea kupuna and we really admire how talented, how intelligent, how strong, how brave, just all of the things that we hope to embody in our people today, they exist. You know, and so we're able to look at these items and at these different moments in time. And yes, it gives us a sense of pride and something to just really use to move forward.
All right, well, mahalo for your time.
Oh, mahalo. Thank you so much.
And we were able to meet one of Pokaro's KS students whose father is Hawaiian and whose mother is British. Lily Mitchell grew up in Aiea. She just graduated from Leeds Beckett University in Great Britain with a degree in graphic design, and she'll be helping out with the exhibit.
So I graduated from Kamehameha in 2022, and I was studying graphic design in Leeds Beckett University, which is in the north of England, for the past 3 years, which was very different. And at university, I was the only Hawaiian, probably the only like local person, definitely like one of very few Americans in the area. So it was like very difficult to be a cultural practitioner, an artist living in like a place that people really struggled to relate or meet me where I was at in my culture.
And you grew up in Hawaii, but your dad's from Hawaii and your mom's from here?
Yes, so they met traveling, as they both had traveling jobs in Barbados, which is very strange. And so yeah, I feel like very honored to have been brought up in Hawaii, but my mom made it such a point for me to come back and be familiar with my English roots and my English family. So I think me coming back so often, I guess maybe like once every year, really piqued my interest in the worldliness of culture and the similarities that can bridge us all in, I guess, different ways, and gave me a lot of courage to be able to travel really far by myself, I think. I'm grateful to her for giving me the opportunity of dual citizenship, because I think her flexibility and independence as a woman is something that she valued. And so as soon as I was born, she did the paperwork to get me dual citizenship, which I'm so grateful. She's the best. I love my mom. And so it helped me give me more opportunities to travel here, and I didn't have to get a visa. Just opened a lot of doors.
We're here tonight at the opening of the Hawaii exhibit. This must be such a sense of pride because you draw from both cultures.
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting that my mom's from England and Hawaii has so many ties to England and the monarchy through our monarchy. And obviously like Captain Cook and voyaging and, you know, all of these connections throughout Hawaiian history. And so it's super, super awesome to see England and London and the British Museum taking pride in showing the relations that we have. And it's super cool to just see other Hawaiians here and like helping bridge that connection too. Because yeah, I'm not used to seeing local people out here in the cold, so it's nice.
And tonight we have people in aloha shirts wearing carnation lei.
Yes, yeah, I'm honestly shocked because when I was making my graduation lei, I had to make all my lei because obviously you can't travel internationally with like flowers. I was struggling to find all the flowers, so I'm very impressed at whoever managed to source all the carnations.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners just about what you think this exhibit means to Hawaii?
Yeah, I think throughout my studies in graphic design, where I looked into analyzing kind of how Western cultures and Western education represented Hawaii, and how a lot of our mo'olelo and history was taken out of context, and Hawaiians weren't necessarily in charge of how our story was told. That I'm super appreciative to Elise and the British Museum for making such an effort to involve Kanaka in the telling of our story here. They mentioned that a board or a group of Pacifica advised on the descriptions and everything, and were heavily involved in curating and picking which artifacts and how they were communicated to the public. And that's not something that is done a lot or has been done throughout history. And so I just feel very proud to witness such a change in the tone in Indigenous history and where our art and representation is going. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to more ways that I can help bridge the gap and be a point of contact for Pacifica or Hawaiians traveling here and looking to put themselves in the seat and at the microphone of telling their story here in the Western world.
And then you are here with your kumu, and there are going to be a number of Hawaii Kamehameha school students coming.
Yes, so funnily enough, my ninth grade English teacher, Kumu Pakaro, and one of my oldest friends, Chase Kamikawa, is here. And I think it's just incredible that Hawaii is such a small community, and I feel very honored to see people that I've, you know, just seen back home here in such a faraway land.
And that was Lily Mitchell, who grew up in Aiea and graduated from college in England. She just moved back to London to look for work and will be helping with programs related to the Hawaii exhibit during its run. And we met another student working on a master's museum studies program at UCLA. Hattie Keona'ona is making the most out of this experience.
I originally visited 2 years ago when the curator Elise Christoph and one of the conservators here, Nicola, mentioned the upcoming Hawaii exhibit to me, and that they really wanted there to be someone who's Kanaka as part of the conservation team. And so I applied for the summer conservation placement. And so part of why I personally wanted to be involved and working at the British Museum is to provide so that there is someone Kanaka who is working with the Mea, to let them know that we're still here, that we're paying attention, and that we're hearing them.
And you are working on a program now at the Getty Museum.
Yeah, so I'm at the master's program, which is an interdepartmental program that was started between UCLA and with the Getty. So my program's name is the UCLA Getty Interdepartmental Program of the Conservation of Cultural Heritage.
That is a long title.
It is a long title. And so ultimately, I'd like to come out of it working with Pacific Mea. My kind of goal for going into a conservation program as well is to help build capacity for Kanaka and for other people to be able to take care of their own Mea and to build that.
What was it like for you at the opening the other night, just to see so many people who were so impacted by the power of that collection?
I think it's really beautiful, and I think about the speeches that were given that night, the way that the exhibit acknowledges Hawaii as a living and currently still Pacific Island Nation, and how that was also acknowledged by speeches and by the people and their responses to the exhibit. I think one of the big things is that this really was an exhibition that had a lot of collaboration from different parts, from Hawaii, different people with their own specialties and their own expertise, being able to work with both on the like curation of the exhibit, talking about the conservation as well. There's just been a lot of partnerships that have been really important.
And so on a cold winter month in London, the exhibit, Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans, rekindles the warm ties of the past. And the exuberance of young Native Hawaiians underscores the pride and kuleana of culture and diplomacy moving into the future. We will have links to programming around the exhibit in the British Museum's YouTube channel to learn more about our ancient Hawaiian treasures, our Mea Kupuna. And that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we revisit the reporting that we've done under the sea. We're looking closely at marine debris and the efforts to turn our trash into treasure. Got feedback about what you heard on our show? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.